Good evening. This is Sarah Robinson, host of Conscious Creating. I'd like to welcome our listeners as we continue conversations on the relationship between art and transformation. Tonight I'm joined by Dr. Pat B. Allen, an internationally recognized artist, writer, art therapist, and teacher, whose books, Art is a Way of Knowing and Art is a Spiritual Path, had inspired others to connect art making with spirituality. Welcome, Pat.
Thank you, Sarah.
You know, I think I may have mentioned in our correspondence that my mother's name was Pat Allen.
Yes, you did.
And it's been a welcome sight to see your name pop up on my emails, but I'm curious, what does the B stand for?
Well, the B stands for Beauty, which was actually my maiden name, and I took it as my middle name when I got married.
How do you spell Beauty?
B-U-O-Y-E.
Oh, okay. It's a pretty name. So, you're a Joycey girl.
Yes, I am.
And you moved, you lived next door to a cemetery. Was that a frightening experience growing up?
No, I can't say it was ever frightening, but it was fascinating. I would spend hours looking out my bedroom window and watching the rituals of funerals and also the just the beauty of the landscape, because probably the cemetery was the largest open green space in my town.
You know, I was curious, and we'll jump ahead just a bit from your early story, but as I noticed that you've spent time in depth psychology and have been a student, among others, of C.G. Jung, I thought about the whole life-death, life cycle and how perhaps those early images looking over the cemetery might have connected you and made it okay.
Well, I think that's true. I think that's very true, because one of the most compelling images for me was the fence that divided our property from the cemetery. It was actually very old and rusty and was almost falling down because it was being pushed over by these intensely lush hedges that were very, very tall. And I was always really struck by that, the sort of decay of the fence and the push of life. And, yeah, there's no question in my imagination, those two things were very fused from very early on.
And interesting that it wasn't frightening, because I think some children would be frightened being in such close proximity.
It could be.
You know, an interesting commonality among my guests thus far is their faith, their Catholicism.
Well, that is interesting.
It is consistent. I have not had a non-Catholic yet. And I'm beginning to think that Catholic families have the corner on the market for creative children. I want to find out about that. Maybe we need to convert to Catholicism. Anyway, do you think there's anything particular that you can point to in your upbringing that might have encouraged or supported your creativity or becoming an artist?
Well, the two things that come to my mind is, one, the sitting in church and looking as a very young child and being completely bored with what was going on in terms of the ritual, but seeing the light stream through the stained glass windows and watching the colors be reflected in around the room. And the other aspects of sort of sensory stimulation, I can still, as we're talking, smell the scent of incense. And the beautiful chant in Latin, which was still the Latin Mass when I was growing up. So there was something very mysterious. There were lots of images, the Stations of the Cross, the statuary, the windows themselves. So there was tons of imagery and a lot of sensory stimulation, and I think that was one part of it for sure. And the other for me was my Italian grandmother, who became an artist very late in life and was always very, very encouraging of self-expression.
I have an Italian grandmother as well. And what was she like, and what do you remember specifically about her encouragement?
Well, I remember that early on, her creativity was mostly expressed in sort of the typical household art. She made lace, she tatted lace, and she crocheted, and she knit, and she cooked. But then, actually, in her 80s, she took up painting. And I really do believe there was something about, I was still very young, there was something about seeing a woman take up something like painting at a very advanced age that's really stuck in my mind, that it was fine, it was good, and it was something to be embraced, whatever form your creativity took. And she also taught me a lot of things. She taught me how to sew by hand and things like that, and was always just kind of always giving me new things to do.
Well, and your the artwork I've seen of yours, or at least the images I've seen, you're very comfortable in multimedia and using, sort of creating in a craft-like way sometimes in your sculpture, aren't you?
Yes, and I hadn't thought of crediting that to my grandmother, but in fact, you know, I really do think that it probably does owe a lot to her, because she would use whatever was at hand. That was the other thing that I learned from her, and I'm sure that was part of growing up poor and living through the Depression and all of those things, but whatever scraps were at hand were things that she put to use, and that's something that's still very much a hallmark of my artwork today.
Yes, you use a lot of found art.
I do.
Right. And the other thing that occurred to me was seeing a woman in her 80s take up something new, painting, must have been inspirational in the sense that do you think that this perhaps is why you've done so many things? You haven't just been a visual artist. You're many different types of artists.
Well, that's true. And honestly, I think I've always kind of credited that partly to the fact of losing my mother to cancer at a fairly young age. There was a message.
How old were you?
I was 15 when she died, but she became sick the first time when I was about 8 years old. So I had a long, most of my childhood was overshadowed by her illness. And the sense that was communicated to me was that it was really important to live life fully, because you never know when it will be taken away.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And there seems to be, for me, some poetry in going back to the cemetery, that as a small child you saw death, and then perhaps that prepared you in some way. I don't know.
I never thought of that, but that could very well be true, because it certainly, in terms of it as a reality, it was certainly something always in my consciousness, although that didn't stop me from being very, very angry about it at the time and for many years afterwards. Mm. I was in a standoff with God for many years.
Were you able to process some of that anger through your art?
Yes. My art and my writing, and ultimately that was really what precipitated my conversion to Judaism. It's interesting you mentioned Catholics being creative. It could partly come out of the frustration.
I had to get out of there somehow.
Well, you know, it was interesting. I was very aware of the platitudes that that a lot of people would say to me or to my younger brothers when my mother was ill and dying, and the kinds of things, and I know that they meant well, but things like, oh, God takes the ones he loves the most, and
goodness,
Jesus suffered, and so, you know, he sends sufferings to those he loves, and things that made me really angry. And there wasn't room in the Catholicism of my childhood to be angry with God, and that really was one of the things that attracted me to Judaism, is that, you know, people, you could shake your fist at God, you could disagree with God. Moses was arguing with God, Abraham argued with God,
right?
You know, Sarah laughed at God, and so it felt like, okay, this is the tribe I need to be in.
And so in 1979, you decided to convert to Judaism.
I did.
And did this decision have any impact on your work?
Oh, I think it had enormous impact on my work. I think it allowed me, it helped me really to access, I think, a much deeper level of grief that really is, it's just so deep, it's so deeply expressed in Judaism, and through the language and the music and the chants and the tunes. I mean, the first time that I heard Hebrew chanted in a synagogue, I just started to cry and felt like, oh, somehow these people understand sorrow. Place that I can feel all the sorrow that I carry.
One of the characters in my last play, Refuge, that was produced was a Jewish woman, and she mourns in a song. And it was not difficult to find material on which to emulate that song or base that song within the Jewish tradition. And I really was quite ignorant to the the tradition initially. So it was great to get into that. There's a lot of imagery in Judaism as well, symbolism, as there is in Christianity. But do you draw ever from the symbols?
I do. I have a lot of Jewish imagery in my work. In fact, one of the most significant images, which I feel I'll probably be processing for the rest of my life, is a painting that's about 7 feet by 5 feet called The Sabbath Bride. And
I've seen an image of it.
Yeah, there's an image of it in my book, Art as a Spiritual Path, and a color image of it on my website, because I think it needs to be seen in color. It right now hangs in my my dining room in California, and it's a very powerful image for me that grew out of listening to a particular, there's a series of songs called L'cha Dodi, and they're the Sabbath Bride, and they're from the Hasidic tradition, and they are the songs that the men would sing to welcome the Sabbath in on Friday night. And they're very joyful, and they're really sort of imagining the Sabbath as this beautiful bride and Israel as the bridegroom. And visual imagery is not that common in Judaism. There's the whole commandment against making images of real things and things like that, which
That's
I think
right.
has changed a lot over the years. But this Sabbath bride image just really rocked me. And over the course of, I think, 5 or 6 years, this painting emerged slowly, piece by piece, until it was finished. And it really is, for me, an example of the depth and power of Jewish imagery. It's really an intense piece of work.
Well, just for our listeners, if you've joined us just recently on Conscious Creating with Sarah Robinson, I'm talking with visual artist and writer Pat B. Allen, author of Art is a Spiritual Path. And if you'd like to see the image to which we're referring, the Sabbath Bride, you can check out her website at www.patballen.com. You write that from an early age, you became adept at leaving your body.
Yes, that's
skill,
true.
Which allowed you to access altered states of consciousness or altered states of reality. Could you describe for me what this was like, both physically and emotionally, and then perhaps extend to how it may or may not have affected or informed your art?
That's a
double whammy question.
That's a good question. I think initially I think this is actually a fairly common phenomenon among creative children. Being bored in school or in any situation where I didn't feel engaged, I would be very, very still, and my mind would begin to wander, and after a brief period of time, I would notice that I no longer felt my body. I had no sensation of sitting in a chair, or this would happen on long car rides. It would happen in the classroom. I mean, I always felt very fortunate that I grew up in a less sophisticated time when there weren't quite as many psychological services for children, and you could get away with a little more daydreaming, because I did it a lot.
I used to have it all over my report cards. She daydreams. Well, that was a bad thing.
Exactly, and I feel like it allowed me to sort of travel between realities and gave me some real relief from the day-to-day life that was sometimes unbearable. And certainly, even as I got older and my mother was ill, it was something that was I could take refuge. The ability to sort of find a place of peace that was mostly consciousness. Now, it had its drawbacks, because I think by the time I was in high school, I was more adept at leaving my body than at being present in my body.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that was a problem. I found after a while that it wasn't as easy to find my way back. And so subsequent to that, through a lot of yoga and body work.
I was just thinking yoga would have been good
for
you.
Yeah, exactly. And
dance and
movement. Those things allowed me to integrate the two. But at the time, it really was a way to to enter an alternate reality where there wasn't pain and there was peace. And so I don't regret it at all. And it allowed me to go to a place where I could dialogue with images, which at an early age seemed like a very common thing to me. So later on, it was something that became a very natural part of my creative process.
So would you say that it opened gateways for you towards a greater sense of creativity, a place where you could access the collective unconscious? I think I read that.
Oh, I would definitely say so. I mean, I think that, as I said, I think that there, it's not always the rosiest thing in the world, because it does, it can become, and I have other creative friends that I've had this discussion with, it can become at times somewhat preferable to the mundaneness of daily life. But once in that state, there's a tremendous sense of being held and seen and felt by a larger force. I mean, I have to say that even being angry with God over the death of my mother or other kinds of things like that, I always felt a sense of being held by a larger force that that I identify now, I would name as the creative source.
And sometimes the out-of-body experience, as you know, as a therapist and having worked with people in mental hospitals and in addictive situations, this can be a vehicle for people who have had terrible abuse to sort of escape, can it not?
Absolutely. There's no question that when the human both body and psyche is confronted with trauma that can't be integrated in the moment, that a part of us kind of goes away. And depending on the amount of traumatic experience that people have had, sometimes a great deal of their personality is missing. And I completely believe that art was what allowed me to retrieve those lost places for myself.
Oh.
And my trauma, you know, compared, there's certainly people who've suffered far worse physical and emotional kinds of traumas that I have, and I have certainly seen in the art therapy process that art, it begins to make a path for those parts to come back.
And perhaps because you have experienced these out-of-body, or I don't know how they're, is it an out-of-body experience? Is that the way you would describe it?
I guess, or just, I mean, I guess more generally altered consciousness.
Altered consciousness.
Yeah.
That perhaps you could have empathy also for others who have left or checked out sort of for different reasons.
Yes, absolutely. And I think I also, I mean, I think I can identify it or recognize it when I see it in people, because I think it's more common than we realize. And I actually think that currently, it's happening in a larger, more pervasive way in our society as people become very, very threatened and fearful in their jobs. You know, are they going to lose their jobs? Are they going to lose their income? Are they going to lose their pension? That even those kinds of things begin to blunt our ability to stay present in the moment, because there's a part of us that's off somewhere worrying about all of these things.
That's right. And I know, as an artist, I have had, I won't say out of body, but certainly altered states occur when I lose time.
Oh, yeah.
When I'm writing or on stage acting or, you know, whatever it is I've been doing. And it is a very positive experience.
Yes. I would say that would be the aspect that I would consider, you know, kind of being in flow, where you really go to that place where everything is possible, and it almost is that kind of paradise of you're living in a timeless moment. Certainly I think that's often what people seek in an escape. You know, Jung was the first one to recognize, I think, and articulate clearly that even addictions were, in his mind, kind of a low-level spiritual quest.
That's right.
And so I think that those things are all related, depending on what our experience is and how desperately we need it and how well we learn to walk the path back and forth.
Mm. So would you call yourself a mystic?
I I think of myself as much more mundane than that.
Oh, come on.
I would say...
You don't sound mundane at all.
Maybe a practical person walking a mystical path, because I do think I am a very practical person. And certainly my artwork also keeps me very grounded at this point in the real world. And I feel like that's the place that's the most important. I don't privilege those altered states more than the daily states. I think that it's important to kind of become limber at dancing back and forth.
Yes, I love that. Become limber at dancing back and forth, because we must.
Yes.
Especially as mothers and people who work and have to show up at a particular time.
Mm-hmm.
One of my Buddhist teachers would, I'm not Buddhist, but I'm sort of an Episcopalist.
Well, sort of like new booze.
That's sort of like Catholic light, L-I-T-E. Anyway, she said that it became troublesome for her because she would get into these altered states and meditate for 6 or 8 hours a day and then forget appointments with clients and, it was just difficult to manage life.
Yeah.
So, when I think of a mystic like Hildegard von Bingen, or, it sounds wonderful, but she accomplished a lot. You accomplished a lot. I accomplished a lot, and yet we can go to a different place.
Yes, and I think that in some ways what we're being called to now in the world is really to have those consciousnesses simultaneously, so that it's not, we don't meditate at one time and then, work on our work, at the other time. That in some ways, and that almost the work that's needed in the community and in the public sphere is calling us to learn to integrate those things in a way that I don't think has perhaps been done. It has been done necessarily before. That's our challenge now, is to transform consciousness so that we can really be that as aware as and connected as a mystic, but in the marketplace and in the politics and really in doing service.
And I think this is an important message and probably will be the result of combining the Eastern and Western ways of being and philosophies, because in the West we tend to be doers, and in the East traditionally there's been less of that and more of the being, but we do need both in order to live our lives effectively.
We do. We do. And the world needs that from us. I mean, the world requires it of us, I think.
Right. If you've just joined us on Conscious Creating with Sarah Robinson, I'm talking with visual artist and writer Pat D. Allen, author of Art is a Spiritual Path. Now, you have had a very full life. You've been a wife and a mother, teacher, visual artist, writer, performer, I was interested in that, public speaker, and art therapist. Now, I want you to tell me exactly where the well is from which you draw all that energy. I'm going there.
Well, honestly, I mean, I have to say, and I must say also before I answer that there have been times of great...
Did I leave something out?
No, not at all. But that there have been times of being very depleted, because I don't want to paint an unrealistic picture. I think that when we learn the path to the creative source, which I believe is through our joy and through our pleasure in service, that it is inexhaustible. I really do believe that. And that the most dangerous part is when we are sort of doing service for others at the expense of our own pleasure. And that sounds kind of contradictory, but I really believe that it's not. That, in fact, just like the dual consciousness of, altered awareness and everyday life, that we also need to have we need to pull together the service of to others as well as the service to self. And to really, that really, in my mind, is kind of the meaning of interconnectedness. That we can't serve others at our own expense, that is the service that kills, not the service that enlivens.
I used to say that charity and compassion
begins at home.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If we don't feel as if our cup is full, we certainly can't give to others effectively. But I do appreciate you sharing that you have felt depleted. And I think for those of us who have read your first book, Art is a Way of Knowing, you were honest about that.
Well, it's important. And I think one of the things that I, if I have any regrets at all, it's looking back to the days when I was still very much in the mode of the child who thought she could save her mother if she just worked hard enough.
No.
And really working so hard and having others see that and think, oh, well, if she has to do that or can do that, then I should do that. And, that sort of breaks my heart, because we really must have compassion for ourselves first. What you said about that is just incredibly true.
In your book, Art is a Way of Knowing, which was published in 1995, you did a lot of exploring. You explored your feelings of grief over the loss of your mother and talked a lot about the tumultuous relationship you had had with your father. What would you say the influence of family has been on your work?
Well, I mean, family is another wellspring. I think we spend a fair amount of our life learning who we are and where we came from, and those things are part of what grounds us in this particular lifetime, I think. And they give us the direction, they give us certain gifts, they give us certain challenges, and it's crucial to embrace those. And so, yeah, family is absolutely the bedrock of my life. And I feel even though both of my parents have passed over to the other side, they feel as present, or even in some cases more present, in my life. Certainly, in a more peaceful way than they even did as my living parents.
It's interesting that you would say that. I've had the same experience. I have lost both parents, and my mother died at a very young age, at 54. And what I tell people that it's as if I have a more loving, more continuous, more constant presence of them as their true selves,
yes,
than I did when they were alive and unable to love me as completely because of their own woundedness,
yes,
as they could have.
Yeah. Yeah, I would completely agree with that. My mother's birthday was June 1st, and her presence was so strong,
wow,
to me that day. And normally it's not so much on her birthday, it's more on the anniversary of her death, which is in March. But this week, this time, it was so strong, and I felt she's really trying to tell me something, and so I tried to spend some quiet time. And the message that I got is that I have such a strong ally in the unseen world, in my mother now, and it's so important for us, I think, to release the images we have of our parents in, in the mundane world. At a certain point, I did a lot of work, and one of the things that came up for me was this person, being my mother was only in one of the things this person was, first of all, and secondly, she no longer is that. She's re-entered kind of cosmic consciousness, and through some of the artwork and witnessing that I did, the message that I received was, if we can release our parents, or anyone really, from the imagery we hold of them from our own childhood or even adulthood, it allows that soul to move on and do its next work.
Oh, that is so beautiful.
And that was just a profound kind of and very freeing insight to me. It was like, oh, I get it. It really does, there really are things going on both ways.
The piece of it that I get loud and clear is that my mother was someone other than just my mother.
Exactly.
That she wasn't defined by that role of mother.
Yes.
And particularly Sarah's mother.
Yes.
Interesting.
Well, and it's funny, I had an interaction with my daughter when she was in high school that made me think, you know, consciousness is transforming evolutionarily. I think the kids, our kids and their kids are just more consciously aware. She asked me to do a piece of artwork for her for a project she was doing, and I was kind of like, oh, I don't, you know, I shouldn't really do it. You know, I'm your mother. And she said, no, Mom, I'm asking you to do this for me as an artist. You just happen to be my mother this time.
That is interesting, Pat.
It was a really kind of matter-of-fact, but felt very true.
I've had that same experience with my high school daughter. I have a 16-year-old, and she comes to me lately less asking me to be her mother and more to be an historian or an actor or an artist or something else, and it's fascinating. I love this part of the mother-child relationship. It's more, not exactly like a peer, but more like a mentor.
Yeah, it's funny that you should say that, because a couple of years ago, my daughter, when she was a senior in college, although she'd grown up with my studio for many years was in my house, and she saw the artwork and she was aware of the process that I taught of intention and witness. She had not really done it in any involved way herself. And during a winter research break, she asked to come and do essentially an internship in my studio.
Wow.
And again, at first I was like, well, you know, come on, you know, what's your professor going to say about that? But he was very supportive, and she did, and that's where the film, we made a film together that came out of that work. And I definitely, it was her ability to sort of see me as separate than just her mother.
And this was just last year, and you collaborated on a film called Art as Inquiry. Was it the emotional cost of intellectual work?
Intellectual work. Yes, right.
That's exciting.
It was very exciting. And we actually presented the film at the American Art Therapy Association annual meeting last year in Atlanta, and it was very well received. It was a very exciting thing to do, and I almost felt like the most important part of it was for people to sort of see what we're talking about, which is, in some ways, our children are more than our children, and we are more than their parents.
Oh,
we are
yes.
sort of colleagues in life, and it was a very humbling and exciting thing.
Can you tell us just a little, I'm really curious about this film, the subject matter.
Well, she had been involved as a student at Tufts University in a very exciting and demanding program called, in an institute there called the Institute for Global Leadership, where every year they take a different topic and study it intensively with all of the experts from all over the world. And the year that she took it, it was oil and water. So the kids were studying, you know, everything from the economics, the science, just everything you can think of, and of course hearing a lot of pretty distressing information, and the amount of information that they were consuming, the amount of books they were reading and speakers they were hearing was unbelievable. And then what they were to do in the spring semester was put on an international symposium based on what they'd learned and putting together panels of experts and things like this that would then present at Tufts. It was fascinating. And in the winter, they were supposed to go do some research for 6 weeks. And what she found was that by the end of the fall semester, she was so blunted and numbed by the amount of information and the direness of it that she'd taken in without really any opportunity to have processed the emotional component. And her response to her professor was, you know, this is an amazing institute. You're training people who are going to be leaders in many different fields, from politics to economics to science to, not NGOs all over the world. But we haven't processed the emotional component of this work. So she came into my studio, and that's what we did.
She was like a 21-year-old kid.
Yeah.
Amazing.
It was pretty amazing.
Look at what you've done.
Well, what was most amazing to me was she did this and then went back and, as a part of that symposium, set up an open studio for that weekend so that people who were hearing these presentations and having the emotional impact of hearing these terrible things about the privatization of water and, the end of oil could come in and make art and relax in a surroundings where they could actually have their emotions and not have to push them aside. And it was just an astonishing thing.
Was it more of a documentary?
Yeah, well, it was a documentary. The film part was a documentary of her process in the studio and also going out into nature and witnessing. It happened to be happening during the winter of the tsunami in Indonesia, and we were in California where the tremendous rains that happened that hadn't happened in 25 years. It literally rained every single day for 20 days. All but one road into our town was washed out. She was inundated with the actual images of this water and then this international phenomenon of the tsunami. So she had had it going on internally. She had it going on in the actual world. And then the artwork was her attempt to find out what is this all about? And what she, and really the gist of her insight was that it's not necessarily all about making new programs and passing laws. It's about noticing the small things and being connected to nature.
Ah.
And it's just having your emotions in the moment so that you're not running out and doing these things out of desperation, but really that you're guided by nature.
That's
so it was pretty intense and a wonderful. It's a beautiful film, and she did some amazing artwork and really struggled, really, really did do the work, which was the biggest part of it.
Amazing. You know, in art is a way of knowing. You described the Open Studio project that you co-founded in Chicago with the intention of making art and being of service. You and your partners created the studio process of art making.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
The studio process involves inviting people to make an intention. And the way we understand that is that our intention is what we personally want to receive in the moment, and that intention is offered literally to the creative source. Now, you don't need to be religious and think of it as God, but there's this energy, and that what we're really asking for when we do creative work is to have that energy flow through us and be expressed somehow. And so we work to have a clear intention, and it might be something very simple like, I deal with the frustration I'm having in my job, or I understand how to be a better guide to my partner, or whatever.
So it's not, I want to be a better partner. It's, I understand how to be a better partner.
Exactly. One of our key insights, which I write about in Art as a Spiritual Path, is recognizing that the word want itself interrupts are receiving what we want. It's essentially saying that we're in a state of want, and that's pretty much how we'll stay until we let that go. Because the place that the creative source is has no before or after. There is no wanting. Every possibility exists there. And that's one of the key insights, is to understand that anything can manifest if we're very clear about accepting it. And we learn that the hard way, because sometimes people would make an intention is just, I open to the creative source, and they would pretty much get knocked on their butt. Like, it's sort of like as if you opened a fire hose and you didn't really know how to control it. It's like, whoa! Yeah, so part of it is learning what is the right relationship to creativity. And so the intention sets the stage for that, and sometimes my intention would be, I work within the limits of my energy. If I had other things that I had to do after an art session, like take care of my family, go to my daughter's softball game, whatever, something that was going to be demanding of me in a different way, then I would ask, I receive from the creative source within the limits of my energy today so that I could do the other things I need to do. Because the idea of sort of privileging creativity over everything, you know, the mad artist, was something also that I think is a faulty construct.
Oh, yes. We don't have to buy into that
archetype, do we? No, we really don't, and I don't think it's wise to. I think it's how we burn out. And also how we do damage, how we neglect people in our lives, we neglect sometimes our own health. I don't think it's a worthy archetype to emulate at all.
So intention is the first part of the studio process.
Right. Intention is the first step, and then entering into some form of creative work. Now, it could be painting, it could be drawing, it could be dance or movement, it could be anything. Something that allows us to sort of alter our consciousness a little bit to go to that place of all possibility.
Right. Excuse me.
And then the final stage is witness.
And tell me about that.
Witness is the moment when we're finished with whatever making and doing, we sit with whatever we've made, and we contemplate, we receive the message from it. We like to have people write a description of what they see in front of them, because we found that a lot of times people would jump immediately to meaning, like, oh, there's a red heart, that's my broken heart. Well, not necessarily.
Hmm.
Let's let the heart speak. So we encourage people to write descriptively, to really see what is in front of them, and then to dialogue with the image, to receive whatever story it had to tell, to ask whatever questions we had, so that really that the image that arrives is a being in and of itself. Sean McNiff, one of my very good friends and colleagues, says that the image is an angel, and it arrives much the way we think of angels in the Bible showing up with a message, and we should extend hospitality to the image so that it will share whatever it has to tell us.
I like that. We should extend hospitality to the image. We should invite it into our home.
Exactly.
Into
and then
ourselves.
Pay attention, like we would to a guest.
And pay attention and listen.
Mm-hmm.
And witness. Hmm. So let's take that very simply. Give a simple intention, if you will, for me, and then let's take that to a particular type of activity, like painting,
mm-hmm.
and then witnessing. Can you run that through?
Well, an intention might be, like, for example, a simple intention could be something like, I make contact with my creative self. It could be that I've been really spending too much time on the computer and doing other kinds of things. And so it's sort of, I reconnect to the creative source.
I'm giggling because I do that a lot.
Well, yeah, we all do.
Yeah.
And we forget, oh, why do I feel so cranky and bored or
right.
so really hopeless or something? So I would then sit and paint for a period of time, and currently, because I'm in my home in Oak Park where I have a little bit of space, I tend to paint fairly small with watercolor. When I have a larger space, I might paint big on the wall or something like that. But the point of it is really to let everything fall away. It's to experience the process of paint on paper and the wonderful, sensuous delight of allowing marks, just making marks, and letting them emerge. Now, that doesn't mean that sometimes there might not be an image in particular that's in my mind that maybe came in a dream that I want to put down. But a lot of times it's just following mark to mark and noticing while that mark making is going on, oh, I hate that. Oh, I love that. Oh, this is awful. Oh, whatever. Anything that comes up, and just watching it rise and fall and rise and fall and rise and fall. And then kind of a sense of that being completed, and then sitting and looking and a watching, noticing. And noticing is probably the biggest word that I use. What is it like to just notice? And then I can read a little bit of a witness that I did a couple of days ago of an image that came up. It turned out to be a green figure. And at various points in the body, the figure's bones were showing through, but the bones were yellow and light.
Please do.
And so what came up? My bones are made of light. You feel it, don't you, through my fingertip, lightly clad in pink skin. Light seeds the marrow, and it blossoms forth when good red blood flows up from the earth. You're surprised, aren't you? Some opt for bones of steel, but light is stronger.
I can see that image.
Well, the image was a very simple one, and the reason that listening to the image is so different is just on the surface of it, bones peeking through the skin of a body. You could go a lot of different ways if you used only your conscious mind with that. But the image always has something pretty important to say.
There's the little girl who grew up next door to the cemetery
again.
I'm really intrigued with that image.
Yeah.
If you've just joined us on Conscious Creating with Sarah Robbins, then I'm talking with visual artist and writer Pat B. Allen, author of Art is a Spiritual Path. So after 6 years, each of you and your partners each moved to onto new projects, and you founded Studio Pardes.
Yes.
Is it Pardes?
Pardes. Mm-hmm.
In a storefront of your home community in Oak Park, Illinois. You discussed the work that you did there in your second book, Art is a Spiritual Practice, which was released just last year. Tell us a little bit about Studio Pardes.
Well, Studio Pardes came at a time when I needed a sanctuary for myself. The work that we had done at the Open Studio Project was very important and very wonderful. And I must say, and this is important, the Open Studio Project continues to exist. Dana Block, one of the three founders, has continued and made it a really wonderful, viable, nonprofit art and social service organization now in Evanston, Illinois. And there was a piece that I still needed to do for myself. It seems to me, if I look back from this vantage point now, that there was some work that I needed to do that perhaps I hadn't done yet for myself, and it was almost like a kind of a spiritual retreat, although it happened in public. And so I created a space that the word Pardes in Hebrew means orchard and garden, and it kind of mystically refers to the Garden of Eden.
Yes.
But also the letters of the word Pardes refer to the four levels of meaning, you know, the simple meaning all the way to the secret meaning. Mm-hmm. So it really was a place for me to find my own balance again. I was certainly seeking something inward, and I couldn't do that and the outward in serving the community in the same kind of way. There were certain things I'd learned. So this was a time of retreat, but retreat in a public space. So essentially what I did was create a space that was more of a sanctuary, and the people that were attracted there were many, many people who were also in transition, needing a sanctuary themselves. And for the next 4 years, that served as a wonderful place in my own community, and I began to understand what it meant to work where you live, because I think that that's crucial. I don't think it's possible to do really viable community work by sort of being a carpetbagger. I think you need to work where you live. And so that was what I began to learn about. And I did several fairly large community projects at Studio Pardes that couldn't have been done except in a place that I also lived.
Well, this is one of the things that really intrigues me about you, Pat. And, you know, we're in a society now where we're in the middle of guru mania. And the gurus are on the television and they're on the radio. I have some of them coming up on my show. God bless them. I'm sure they're wonderful people. But everything's about personality and big message. But you have really embraced this idea, whether you know it or not, I don't know if you articulate it like this, of the servant leadership in your own community.
Yes, I think that that's a very that probably sums up the reason for why I closed Studio Pardes, because I saw that people are very willing to make you a guru, mm-hmm. If you're willing to accept that mantle. Mm-hmm. And I knew that that was wrong for any number of reasons. For one thing, it wouldn't allow me to be a full person. It wouldn't allow me to be complete. And I think that this was also one of the strongest pieces of learning that I've done in my life, which is this is the time when we really, really must look past the idea of a guru. We must activate that in each one of us. And for a couple of reasons. One is when we make someone a guru, we project our light onto that person.
Right, right.
And we also make them carry our shadow.
Because they're going to screw up at some point. You know,
yes,
they will.
Yes, they will.
And it will all come tumbling down.
Yes, and in a very dramatic way. And it isn't fair. It's not fair to them. It's not fair to ourselves. And we all need to kind of claim our own authority and kind of we all need to do the work. It's not a matter of one or two people doing it for the whole. You know, back in simpler times, there could be a shaman that served the whole community. But now we need to do that for each other. And we also need to move around, you know, kind of past the talking stick, past the authority stick. Rabbi Zalman Shachter Shalomi, who's one of the teachers I dearly love, he calls it rebbitude. He's a rabbi. And he says, we need to pass the rebbitude from person to person so that different people sit in that seat at different
right.
times.
And I say that in my work. I like the kind of teaching where there's an ebb and flow to the leadership. I don't like to be put up on a pedestal. Mm-hmm. Not that I don't have something valid to share. I do.
Mm-hmm.
That takes me to another sort of edgy topic here. I hadn't planned on discussing it, but I think we'll go there. Along with guruism is the selling of spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes big business.
Yeah.
And not just for the mega churches, or I don't think it's so big in Judaism, except Kabbalism has become big business.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the New Age movement with the gurus who've made millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. Well, what are your thoughts on all this?
Well, this is an interesting topic and one that I think a lot about. I think in particularly in relation to creativity and the creative aspect of it, that we need to begin to imagine a commerce-free sphere of creativity and a commerce-free sphere of spirituality. And I think of someone like Lewis Hyde, who wrote a beautiful book called The Gift. We need to return to a gift economy. I mean, probably the largest issue facing us today is, you know, capitalism is a system. It's just an idea. It's not the best idea. It has a lot of shadow to it, and it's time for us to start to look at it in a critical way and to understand the implications for doing things on a large commercial scale and to take away the idea that what success means is the most money or the biggest. And my teacher in this regard, and I'm delighted to have a chance to mention him, is Rabbi Michael Lerner, who is the founder of Tikkun Magazine and the Tikkun community. And Tikkun means repair in Hebrew. It's
how do you spell that?
T-I-K-K-U-N. Tikkun Olam is the statement. In Judaism, you're required to do Tikkun Olam and Tikkun HaNefesh, and not to neglect one or the other, to heal the world and to heal your soul.
I think the converts to Judaism know more about Judaism than the people who were born Jews.
Well, in some ways, there's a lot of pretty learned Jews out there. But the idea, he's proposing the idea of a new bottom, what he calls a new bottom line for America, that we redefine what success is. We redefine money being the primary arbiter. Because really, it's almost unquestioned in our society that if something makes money, well, then it's okay.
Yes,
it is. It's good, and it's better.
And people who are wealthy have value.
Yes, exactly. And if you truly throughout history, the wisest people have not been wealthy. They've been very poor. And there's a tremendous tradition in all the spiritual traditions of that. And we need to get back to that, I think. I really do think it's important. I don't think it's a terrible thing to make money. I think that's fine. But what you do with it and how responsibly you steward that, and I think it's time to really call that out. I'm glad that you're bringing it up.
Hmm. I'd like to talk about that some more at some point, because I'm not against money at all. I like money, and when you work 60 hours a week on a project, you need to get compensated for it.
Absolutely.
But even when we have the fortune of making a lot of money, what do we do with it?
Yes.
what do we do with it? Because I believe that the, I believe that money comes to us so that we can make good choices.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Jesus having said in the Bible that, you know, it's more difficult for a camel to get through an eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to get into the into heaven. This metaphor is has always been important to me.
Yes, and that's true throughout the traditions. You know, there would be no Buddha had he not, you know, kind of given up his fortune and his palace and his wealthy life. I mean, there is something about that. I feel like this is a really a crucial issue right now. The gap between the wealthy and the poor has grown to a point where, and I think there's, you know, we're it's like a trance that we're in. When you read that somebody, you know, some CEO was compensated to the tune of hundreds of millions, you think, oh, I'm really not very well off. I'm really kind of poor. But when you put yourself on the other side and realize there are people who live on a dollar a day, and that's probably a third of the world, then we have to really put ourselves where we really belong. And I think that that's a huge challenge.
And I tell my children, because they go to a private school and are around extremely affluent people, and I say, you know, it's all relative. That
exactly.
We are very wealthy compared to some people, but we're very poor compared to others. And it's just not all that important in the end. And it's difficult for children who are put into those environments to see that.
But yes.
Maybe that's the challenge for them.
I think that is a challenge. I think that is a challenge for them, particularly the children of parents who've succeeded financially, succeeded professionally. It's like, well now what do you do? Well, I certainly hope, I know it was my intention and my husband's intention that to raise my daughter to feel that you have privilege and with privilege comes responsibility and the need to serve.
Right.
So I hope that that happens. We'll see.
Now, I'm curious. We're sort of running out of time, so I want to make sure I get to this question. I was just really excited to see that you have done a lot of performing. Tell me about your performances.
Well,
of course, as an actor, I have to hear all about
them. Well, it's certainly not acting. The performance things that I've done are they're very low tech. I would say they're sort of in the performance ballpark of the kind of found object things. I've been a part of a drumming circle in which we play, and I do mean play music, as opposed to anything more elevated than that. I feel that my performance persona is that of the fool, and it's a wonderful place for me. It's a very renewing place, and it's an edge, certainly. But those performance things have been primarily of creating rituals for people, and definitely playing the fool. That
can you be specific? Tell me about you as a fool. Make a fool out of yourself.
Well,
radio.
I feel that there's an image that's come. In fact, I'm working on another film right now, which is sort of a self-portrait as fool. There's an image that's come in my paintings of this kind of clown-like, kind of white-faced figure with, like, red and white striped pants and a little pointed hat. And he kind of wanders around trying to do good, not really knowing how to do that exactly, and what he learns is that his art making is like a shield. It's both what keeps him somewhat safe, but it also is, the shield is a mirror, and the purpose of it is to mirror back others' beauty to them. And that's kind of the way I see being the truly in my soul, but the creative person in me is the fool that just wants to be able to mirror others' beauty back to them. Mm-hmm. That's what it's all about.
And do you like to play?
I do like to play.
I do too. We talk about liking, I like the art making to be like playing in a sandbox.
Mm-hmm.
Getting in there with people I like. You and I'll have to get in the sandbox.
We will, definitely.
Pat B. Allen, thank you for talking with me tonight. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I hope that we'll have a chance to continue this dialogue in the future.
I hope so, too. Thank you so much, Sarah.
I encourage our listeners to learn more about Pat's work by visiting her website at www.patballen.com.
Thank you for joining us on Conscious Creating this and every Thursday evening. We hope you'll visit our website at www.consciouscreating.com to learn more about the show, my art, and to give us your thoughts on what you heard tonight. Conscious Creating is made possible through my collaboration with Susan Pearson, associate producer, and the generosity of Donald and Doug Newsom at VBS Radio. This is your host, Sarah Robinson, wishing you a fruitful week of conscious creating.
LoginService.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.